Champions, our guest today has been in the top 100 in the world for many years. He has trained and competed in elite tournaments with legends like Karpov, Kasparov, Anand, Kramnik and Carlsen. He was even a European team champion. Yet, despite all this success, I always felt he was not truly happy. After I retired from chess, we lost touch for many years, but we recently met again at the Chess Olympiad in Budapest, and he was completely transformed. His energy, his smile, it was like meeting a different person. I asked directly, "George, what has happened?" As he began sharing his journey, I found it so fascinating that I had to interrupt him and say, "George, wait, wait, come to Chessmood podcast." And he said, "Okay." What you are about to hear, my friends, is Grandmaster George's journey, his ups and downs in chess and life, stories with chess legends, his thoughts on success and happiness, the importance of finding purpose, and much more. This conversation left me with a smile in my heart, and I hope it will positively impact you too. George, thank you very much for accepting the invitation and coming here in the middle of the tournament to come to talk to me at Chessmood Podcast.
It's a pleasure, Vitek.
I could not to ask you, because when I saw you in the at the dinner, it was like, okay, this is George Meyer, but I remember him very differently. I remember the first time we played in 2006 when you beat me very badly. Then we played more, yeah, but I have never seen you this happy. Yet at the same time, you had 26-70 at some point. Now you lost 100 points, but your face was happier. Like, first time I saw you, like, happy. Maybe before you were also happy, but your energy was different. Tell me what happened to you.
Where to start?
Beginning.
Yes. So, yeah, when we first met, it was in the winter in Moscow.
Yeah.
So that doesn't make me too happy to be in the cold. And actually, I do not even play well in the winter. I noticed this long time ago that, yeah, it's a difficult period for me. I enjoy the warmth, and if it's too hot, like 30 plus degrees and humid and everyone is sweating, I survive, yeah, then the others suffer. So I have to avoid the cold. But yeah, back then my life was, I would say, mostly focused on chess, and especially being a player, because I never had any other ambitions in chess. Not in terms of producing any type of content, even books, or to be a coach. I just wanted to be as strong as possible as a player. But, well, we will probably go back and forth, but there was a period where I realized that kind of this is not enough for me.
When did it happen?
So I was a professional player after finishing high school. That was the period from 2007 to 2011, roughly. Or 2008 to 2011. So about 4 years.
When did you become a European champion? 2011?
2011. It was my first tournament as a student. I had just started studying in the US and flew back to Europe to play with the German team.
In Webster University.
Yes, yes. It wasn't yet Webster. It was Texas Tech. And after 1 year, the program switched to Webster University. So that was already the end of this period, but I had understood that kind of to limit myself to chess, it will not satisfy me, and that I will actually lose my motivation altogether.
Wait, 2011, after, like, about that time when you became the European champion, you realized that...
No, before.
Before.
Yes, I had already taken the decision to kind of change my trajectory to...
And then accidentally you became European champion?
Well, not accidentally, I mean...
I mean
I was kind of at my best at that point, because I was just about to change my status, but, you know, I was still a very good player at that point. And only afterwards did chess kind of become less important and gradually less and less and less. So what I wanted to do with studying was simply kind of open up my horizon. I didn't have a clear idea where this is going to lead to, but it was kind of a new path. And nowadays I see a lot of the chess professionals that are really restricted. Like, they have only developed their intellect through chess and only used it for chess. So it's logical that you can't have deep conversations with many of them on other topics because they didn't develop in that way. I was also like that, and I didn't want to stay like that. So this is the reason why I kind of chose a different path. And then, of course, still a lot of things happened. Funnily enough, I think almost everyone thought I was still a professional, because after 2011, every year I was invited to some super tournament in Germany. Before that, never, when I was a professional. When I was a student, yes. So, and such opportunities you cannot refuse. It's a blessing for any player to get them. I was very lucky to have these chances, but I was playing these super tournaments, not being a professional anymore.
For example, which super tournament did you play?
In Dortmund many times.
Many times.
And Dortmund. Then there was this Baden-Baden tournament. Later I was kind of split between Karlsruhe, where they have this big open, and then Baden-Baden too. So that's how I played Magnus, Vichy, Kramnik, all these people many times.
So that's a dream for many chess
lovers. Yeah, of course.
To play against such legends.
Yes.
And you are playing at the period when you were deciding to switch to do something else.
Yeah, and like in no way, you know, can I complain about having these opportunities. But if I had been a professional, it would have meant something else. It would have helped me develop more as a player, but like that I couldn't. You know, I couldn't start playing new openings because how, you know. So this is like also the reason why I was always playing my French. Sometimes it really hurt to know that I'm going to play the super tournament and again have to defend with my French. And I was learning other openings, and then I was like, okay, I play Vichy Anand. Is this going to be the first time that I play the Petrov? I mean, come on, yeah. So what to do, yeah.
And then you decided to go. This is the period where you moved to the USA to study economics.
In the US, you study 4 years for a bachelor's degree. Uh-huh. So basically, the first year, you have time to orient yourself. You take so-called electives, which can be anything. I took some class, introduction to cinematography, some class on US history, business French, some German literature, whatever. And so after 1 year, you need to figure out what is it that you are going to study. So since I was in Texas at that point, for the first time I realized that speaking a couple languages is actually special. Because, well, there they kind of speak one language. And I kind of grew up with four. So I figured out, okay, it needs to be something international.
Which four? German?
German, French, Spanish, and English.
Uh-huh.
And in school I even had Latin, but I mean, it doesn't count. It just
from where
helps.
Do you learn Spanish and French?
My mother, basically. She speaks all those languages plus Italian too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it was kind of given to me. So she could practice with me whatever. I grew up close to the border to Luxembourg and France. So she taught me German and French at home. And we visited Uruguay very regularly in my youth. So basically, a couple of weeks before going to Uruguay, we would start speaking Spanish at home, and then we were there for like 4 weeks. So as a child, I just learned Spanish like this, just going to Uruguay and like soaking it up. And even though I never had any kind of lesson, I'm kind of fine, you know, for everyday stuff, conversations, little interviews, I manage in Spanish.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in the university, you realize the power that you speak languages?
Yeah, so I figured out what I study should be international. So what then? They had international business, which is management studies. So that's how I started. Then at some point I took classes in international relations, in economics, in political science. And when I was done with my bachelor's degree, I already felt that, okay, I'm interested in economics, because when you study like these other things, international relations, political science, they stop with the explanation of society when there are economic motives at play. So I felt this is very frustrating, you know, I want to understand everything. So I had to study economics. And then my master's degree was in Stockholm, where I studied at the Stockholm School of Economics, and the degree was, I think, international economics.
Mm-hmm. Remind me, when did you hit your peak, 26, 71? What? Which year? It was. It was when you were studying.
Maybe it was right after the European team that we won in 2011. I think it was just after that.
So that period you were playing, you were being invited to play in Dortmund and such
afterwards,
top tournaments, and you were also studying.
Yes. So I kind of kept this level actually for quite a while because these tournaments, they motivated me to, you know, keep studying some chess. But I studied to kind of keep my level and work my repertoire, but I didn't study to like really improve.
Mm-hmm.
That's the crucial part, because to improve at that level, it's a full-time job. Then you need to limit yourself and just do this, and you know, that's already the path I had left. But I like chess. I like to study chess. I mean, when I see some instructive material, you know, some nice article, yeah, I enjoy this. But to kind of focus my life on it, that's a different thing. And that's a difficult decision. There are a few people for which this is really their life's calling, like Magnus, for example, Kasparov, it's obvious. Yeah, they were kind of made to play chess, to spend their life playing chess. But I think for most, so to say, mortals, it's maybe not the best idea. But, you know, to have chess in your life, that's a good thing. But if you make your life mostly about chess, that's another decision.
Yeah, I know. I absolutely understand that, because myself at some point I wanted to do something else, so I absolutely relate myself. I remember, and forever I will remember, when I played first time against Vishyanand, it was totally another experience, and I will take it to my last day. So you played all these top players. For you, is it the same? Like, there are games that you played and you are feeling the moment and you didn't want that game finished because you are playing at that.
So I was so lucky that, for example, I played Kramnik, I don't know, maybe 8 classical games.
8 classical
almost
games
a match,
with Kramnik?
Yes. So if I'm right, he won 6, I won 1 and 1 draw.
Uh-huh.
And with him, I mean, he kind of had me figured out. But then I played Vichy 4 times with black, and he struggled to finish on -1. Yes.
Against your French?
Yes. I had 1 white, sorry. So the white was a draw, and then 3 blacks, all against my French.
So you are plus against Vichy?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I won one of these black games, and the others are drawn.
Against Carlsen how?
No, some big minus. I have a couple draws, but yeah, maybe 2 draws. I had 1 chance to win a game, I missed it, and so 2 draws and maybe 3-4 losses, I don't know. Something like that. But okay, Carlsen is a different level, and I played him also in his peak. I mean, Kramnik and Anand, they were already past their peak. But it was interesting for me that I had such difficulties with Kramnik. I can also understand why. And with Anand, I just didn't fit him. Like, it's somehow, you know, I just don't fit him. So these were like, you know, struggle like mano a mano, yeah?
Have he ever told you, like, what's happening with you, George? Why you cannot make
No,
you?
Actually, like, I think the first game he was white, like, he had a nice idea in the opening, he got some advantage, he got a much better endgame, and he was playing fast, but then I was playing fast too, and I actually managed to outplay him from this worst endgame, and missed the chance to win, like, study-like. So that was the first draw, and after the game, he says in German to a friend of his, wieder so ein Scheißtag, which loosely translates into another messed up day, you know. So he was clearly unhappy.
So Arnold speak German?
Yes. So I think the next time I drew him with black, he already, you know, accepted it. And then the third game where I beat him, he just, you know, shake hands, no comment. Yeah, he accepted, yeah.
So he was happy that you retired and that you were not invited to Dortmund anymore, yeah?
Him I played in these Baden-Baden tournaments.
So maybe you stopped playing, they stopped inviting you because Anand told them, please, if this guy plays, I'm not coming, so they picked Anand.
No, actually, the last one of these that I played, I said to the organizer that I will not play anymore because it doesn't make sense. They need to invite some other young player, you know, that actually will benefit from this.
Wait. that's like sounds very smart. There is, it sounds very stoic, very anti-egoistic, but most of the people have problem with that. How did you do that? It's for generation who is like strong, and then they need to give path to young, to youth. It's for mostly it's very difficult to do such thing, to say okay, I enjoy playing against Anand and Kramnik, but I understand that best for my country is to do that. Like how it comes that mentality.
As you can see, I have like a sober view on you know, the development of my chess career and my other decisions.
What do you say? Sober view?
Sober, like...
Sober view, okay.
Like...
Yeah.
It's not... I'm maybe more detached than most. So it's like I can take a step back and look at the situation. And okay, I did play a lot of these events. And I also saw the difficulty I had to prepare every year. And so I felt like it just doesn't make sense. Because imagine... You get to play once a year against Roger Federer and Novak Djokovic, and the rest of the time you play tennis with your children. Like, it doesn't make sense, yeah? Like, So that's how I felt.
That's great. That's like... I see many federations are struggling with that. Many people are not giving the enough path to others, and they are... keeping with them, so that's
something. And actually, the last time I played this Baden-Baden tournament, I decided, okay, I take one of these young German guys as a second, and the idea was for him to learn something. So He sees how this goes in the tournament, how I prepare, how these games go, and now he's actually the number two in Germany, cool. Dimitri Kollers. So back then he was kind of unknown, he didn't get any support, and I have thought, okay, I have this small opportunity to help him a little. So that was the last super tournament I played. I didn't play well, but I guess for him it was at least interesting.
Did you realize it, or you're not sure?
No, I think I also more or less told him that why, you know.
Did you officially announce that you are retiring, or you were just, okay, I'm just stepping down a little bit, I will play,
passively? I never announced anything. I mean, I was still good enough to play on the German national team, so I kept playing. So I could kind of balance, you know, studying, playing chess, that's easy. But then eventually I started to work a full-time job, and then it becomes really hard to balance your chess activities. And that was the time where, well, I had difficulties on a lot of fronts in my job, which was not the right one for me.
Which was the job? What were you doing?
I was working in a small bank, the Grenke Bank, which is part of this basically a bigger Grenke company, which is the big sponsor in German chess. Not the only one anymore, but they have this strong Bundesliga team, Baden-Baden, and they organized this big event in Karlsruhe, the super tournaments, all of this. And the best thing they did in all these years was actually at some point to really support Vincent Keimer. So with really serious funding, they allowed him to work with Peter Leko, and well, obviously this was a good decision by them. So I was working there, but working in the bank was not the right field for me. I was a risk controller, and this was my first job out of university, and I never thought I would work in a bank at all, because kind of the finance world didn't appeal to me. But you can imagine, this job was offered to me. And when you are new to the job market, either you get a job through a connection or you struggle, you're most likely not anyways in a position to choose. So you have to start with something.
But being a grandmaster was not helping?
In Germany, sadly, no.
Okay.
If you are very lucky and you kind of find someone on the other side who's like in hiring people who has something to do with chess,
understands
it will count for you, but otherwise not at all.
Okay.
It's like you play cards or whatever, you know. So yeah, that's how it is in Germany. I know some fellow grandmasters my generation. Just some other grandmasters my generation that are also like having normal jobs. One of them, Arik Braun, world under 18 champion at some point. I'm not even sure he puts it on his CV, you know, it's on that level.
Really?
So Grandmaster, you put like on your hobbies or something. It's a bit sad, I have to admit, yeah. Because obviously there are countries where this will help you more, but not in Germany.
It helps, you know, how much in our country.
Yeah, I know.
I will even tell you a story related to Brown Arik. The year Brown Arik became Grandmaster, but also he became world champion, right? In Georgia. He lost the first round, Brown Arik, and he then won 8 games. And with 8 out of 9, he became a world champion. The first game he lost to Armenian guy, with whom we were in the same university. And the day he went, and he was not prepared for the subject, and the professor asked, like, you are not prepared? He said, yeah, but I'm chess player. And they asked, like, you are chess player? Are you grandmaster? And he said, no. Like, what success do you have? You are chess player. And he said, I recently beat the world champion. Because he really beat the first round. He beat the guy who eventually became the world champion. Like, oh, you beat world champion. Okay, you got it. Yes. You got it. Good luck. And I was talking to James Altucher, who is in the USA doing many things. And he told, like, with being a national master, it opened so many doors for him. That's why I asked, like, being a grandmaster didn't help.
Well, if you want a comparison between Germany and the US, the German economy historically is an industrial economy.
Mm-hmm.
You need a lot of people doing simple jobs, and a few people who are the leaders, you know, who give the direction. So in Germany, the mentality comes from there in the working sphere, that you are rewarded for putting in the work. You know, you go up the ladder because you work 10 years, because you work 15 years. It's less about your skills or the performance you deliver. And of course, in the US, it's not like that.
Mm-hmm.
They are interested in who you are, what you bring to the table. And, you know, if they think you are special, they're going to make you an offer accordingly, and there are no obstacles. So this is really different ends of the spectrum and how these things can work.
Got it. I interrupted you and took you to... I had questions to ask, but you were telling that you had a difficult period, so you were having problems at the job. That was one thing. What were the other problems I was asking about? How did you slow down playing?
Yeah, so basically, I had great difficulties with the German Federation at the same time as I had difficulties...
Which year?
That was actually the Corona time, so everything was kind of bad at the same time. Those were like 2020, I would say, when the situation was very bad, and 2021 too.
Can I ask what problems did you have with German Federation? Whatever you are comfortable to share.
No, I kind of want to give you a simple answer, not to make a very big story about it, but... Basically, in German chess, of course, I'm a public figure.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another public figure that decided basically to humiliate me in public, to even insult me several times. And so I looked to the Federation to do something, because I said this cannot go on. So they were not interested in doing anything. So I said, okay, guys, then I don't want to talk to you anymore. I don't want to have anything to do with you guys. Just let me switch federation. Yeah, I understood immediately the situation and didn't want, you know, any greater conflict out of this. But I said, no, we don't let you go. Because at that point, basically, if the federation doesn't let you go, you have to skip like the official tournaments for 2 years, like the FIDE tournaments, or your new federation needs to pay, I don't know, 25,000-30,000 euros. So that was the situation. I asked them, let me go at least, yeah? And they said no. And then kind of I was fighting more with them because, well, then they kind of forced me to. And in a way, through Corona, there was a break. So anyways,
so eventually,
didn't play.
Anyway, you didn't play.
Yes. So I got closer to these 2 years. And then they even changed the rules on FIDE level. That if you're a citizen or... Well, something changed so that I could just switch and play. So basically, I got to the point where I could just switch. This is how the situation with the Federation ended. And with my job, yeah, I needed another job because, like, this type of work in a bank, it's kind of repetitive. So there is a routine. You do this for a couple of years. You know how it works. You can do this for another 30 years until retirement. But I didn't see me doing this at all. Yeah, that's also not what I left chess for, to do something like this. So I managed to switch federation. I'm very happy with the Uruguayan Federation, which you see. Yeah. And I also managed to switch job, and that was the most important development.
So your job now is in the Uruguay as well?
No, I live very close to Frankfurt, and I work for a company that's called GIZ.
Okay, so you didn't move to Uruguay, you just changed the federation, yes. But you live in Frankfurt.
I have double citizenship.
I see.
Since in Uruguay there is a law that gives citizenship to children of all Uruguayans. And since my mother was born in Uruguay, she obviously gave me that citizenship. Mm-hmm. And if you have more than one by birth, then Germany lets you have more than one. Mm-hmm. So I was always entitled to switch because of my citizenship. So this is also unusual because nowadays you see a lot of people that switch for economic motives. Yeah, they go live somewhere and they get a good offer, they switch. So this was not the case with me. I actually had some connection to Uruguay since my childhood, and that was the logical step for me. If I cannot play for Germany for whatever reason, then I will play for Uruguay happily.
So it's what I don't want to dive deeper there and touch unpleasant things, but it still sounds very like strange that like one public figure insulting the other public figure, and the federations complicate the things instead of just resolving and then eventually losing one of their top players who has helped the other generations. That sounds like very, very strange.
In Europe, players from most countries, they like to complain about the federation. This is like standard.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
Yes. So, you know, I don't need to make it a topic about the German Federation, but I think that in most sports federations in general, not just chess, the people who are in the leadership have, you know, their own motivations, and they are usually non-aligned with the objectives of the top players. So as a top player, you think the federation should be doing something for you, but these people that sit there, they're not at all interested in doing anything for you. So when there is a clash with them, this becomes even more obvious.
I see.
And, well, I already knew this, of course, but, you know, then there was a situation where they really needed to do something and they still didn't. And then I was like, okay, it's enough. Because anyways, it was easy for me to kind of leave the German Federation because I don't have professional ambitions. So the problem was I was feeling that, you know, I was getting bad energy from my work, bad energy from German chess. And I could feel that soon I can't play chess anymore because there is no energy left. So if I wouldn't have made these changes, I wouldn't be playing chess at this point. That's how I felt, and I'm actually convinced of it. So, and then switching to Uruguay, that was like, you know, giving me
fresh air.
Fresh air. And also I knew there I will be respected. I will have no problems. I will enjoy playing with the team, representing the country. And it's exactly how it is since 2021. So I even managed to...
This is your second Olympiad.
Yes. And now once a year I kind of fly to the Americas, play some event. And the first time I played Continental Championship, which is for whole Americas, I won it. Mm. So of course I'm the first Uruguayan to ever win it. Yeah. And I didn't need to qualify to the World Cup because we had one spot through the Olympiad. But I went, I won, and I qualified another Uruguayan like this. Because, well, so that was nice. Yeah. And you can imagine, like, the feedback I got from Uruguay, you know, it's something I can't imagine in Germany. I mean, we were European team champion 2011 with the German national team. It's the only time in German history that Germany won such an event. And the feedback was nothing in comparison. It was so sad.
Did you get some chocolates?
better than this what we have. No?
Okay.
Well, that was kind of also a break with the German chess scene. I will tell you what. Well, payment is nothing special for the national team, but there was a bonus. And the contract back then, it was €800 per person if we finish, I don't know, top 3 or top 5. So after we won, I knew we will get more, but I said, of course, it will be some other ridiculous amount. So we got €2,000 as a bonus. And you know yourself, there are many countries where you win, you know, there are some more zeros in the bonus, and then you get a flat, and maybe the president will come with a private jet and, you know, bring you home, and no.
Yeah, that's what's happened with Armenia.
I know. So, of course, when you have the biggest possible success with the team and you see it gives you nothing, that's tough, yeah?
Yeah.
Because before, you know, you can only fantasize, you know, what would happen if, you know, one day we would win? Maybe, you know, things would change, and then you win, and then yeah, fuck it, yeah, like... You get to see that nothing changes, and that, of course, kind of reaffirmed my decision, yeah, to leave chess. I mean, as a professional player.
How is Uruguay Federation? Are your motives aligned? Do they ask recommendation here because they got such a player? How is it going?
So everything is upside down compared to Germany, because German Federation has money, they have some budget, more than €1 million a year. Half of it they spent on administration. Yeah. In Uruguay, they basically have no money. So I knew this from the start. So when I switched, I said, look, guys, I don't want anything. I play for free for the team. That's fine, you know? And I had to explain this several times because people thought this is not possible. How can someone from Europe switch to South America? Because it's usually the other way around. South American players go to Europe because they are more tournaments, they can make some money. Yeah. So kind of the stuff I explained until everyone got it. Yeah, there is no secret deal, no nothing. I just like to play chess, and so I will just play for Uruguay. And if they can do something for me, that's cool. If we can do something together, that's also cool, but... You know, it's on that basis. And since Uruguay is too far away, I can't go regularly.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pity. I would like to, but it's not possible to combine this with my work life. And so, for example, I get along with everyone there. So one of the guys who's like currently the coach of the women's team, you know, when I was in Uruguay in January, we go to eat together and he's like, oh, can you do, you know, some talk, some lesson with the women's team? Yes, of course I do that. You know, it's kind of on that basis. If there are ideas, I support. And, you know, if they can support me, like to go to the Continental, you know, they ask the ministry, they get some money for my travel. That's also nice. Yeah. So everyone is happy. And then I bring them even some success. And yeah, for them, that's just nice as well.
Yeah, and also it's, I think like any time a federation that is developing their country, their chess, and they get a strong player as a player or as a coach, it often gives a huge boost because the others are getting more interested, they are more inspired, they see a figure from whom they can learn, the coaches will learn from you and the other coaches will learn from those coaches, and then there is influence that over the years it changes federation. Do you think so?
I'm making a small contribution, you know, if what this leads to remains to be seen, but I do what I can with my limited time. So when I was in Uruguay last January, February, it was timed so that I could play in the one annual event that they have in the capital. It's called like the Marcel Duchamp Open or Cup. No Uruguayan had ever won it. So the organizer asked me, George, once you need to come and please win it. So I won it. And every day someone would come to me and be like Uruguayan chess fans. And, you know, like, it's such an honor that you play for our country. And then he would take the next guy and explain, you know, who I am, that I switch and how great that is. Next day someone comes, he has some first edition of some book by Smyslov, and he's like, oh, I read an interview with you, George, and I saw that Smyslov is your idol, please take this gift. You know, every day something nice like that. And none of these things would ever happen to me in Germany. It's a different mentality. Yeah. people are not so warm and open, and there every day was like fun like this.
I see, like here also, yes, you feel yourself very relaxed. I feel like you feel yourself as in a home.
Yeah.
I feel like you feel very good with Uruguay team.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So for me, it's every day I play with them, it's fun, yeah.
So now it's like transformation, the job became better, there is no conflicts, you play for a federation where you feel better, and just a few years ago, you were in deep crisis, right? Everything was going badly, yeah? Do you know the Chinese hieroglyphs that stands for crisis?
No.
It is two hieroglyphs. One is danger. One hieroglyph stands for danger. The other hieroglyph stands for opportunity. So crisis for them, it's like it's crisis, but it's an opportunity to grow. So what was your mindset when you were in this crisis? Was it like, it will pass as well, it will go good? Like, how did you keep yourself during the crisis?
Yeah, in a way, I understood that there is a structural problem. You know, like from two sides, I'm getting, so to say, bad energy. So I need to make changes. That's also why, you know, often out of a bad period, good can come, because you're also forced to look at yourself, at your life, and yeah, through the pain, you're kind of forced to look for a way out. So yes, this was all very constructive, and I'm very happy with what it led to. Because if I can tell you about my job, which is kind of maybe the most interesting change. So there is this company in Germany, GIZ. It's owned by the German government. We are around 25,000 people.
My neighbor in Armenia is from GIZ, so I know a little bit about them.
Yeah, it's a very big player in the world of development cooperation, development aid. And when I interviewed for the job that then I got, I told my future bosses that I think GIZ is my natural employer in Germany, and I kind of agree by now, because
what do you mean natural?
Because it's important that you speak colonial languages, because well, the countries where we work, they at some point have been colonized, many of them,
and you speak French and Spanish.
French, Spanish, well, English of course. So in the end, I work on projects in Africa because well, my languages fit there with French and English. I could also do Spanish, but you can't do everything at the same time. It's just still one person only. But the type of work we do, we are not for profit. That's why it's important that I mentioned that we are owned by the German government. The projects we implement, the goal is not to make any money, but the success of the project is measured by the impact of the project, that we manage to improve the living conditions where we implement the project. So, and that's really interesting when you can truly work towards implementing the goal of the project and not have financial incentives. You know that you need to save some money here, be more efficient there, because then someone gets a bonus. This doesn't work well together with this kind of work. So here it's like kind of the way it should be. And well, I'm lucky to be in Germany for this, because of course Germany as a rich country can also afford such a structure and kind of do this kind of work. So yeah, this is for me like the nice chess is, you know, a microcosmos. You know, it might feel like I don't like Germany, and it's not true at all. It's just that I had a difficult experience in German chess, but I know how privileged I am growing up in Germany, living there, and I also found like something that's really good for me and where I can bring my qualities. And you can imagine the people that work in this kind of company, they're kind of also looking for something like this. So it's a very collaborative atmosphere, very friendly, maybe like chess mood. Yeah?
You have the right mood there. And George, do you know what is living dharma in Eastern philosophy? Have you heard about that?
No.
So living dharma, it is when you do something in your life that you are passionate about, that you love it. This is one thing. The second thing is when you have expertise in that. And the third thing is when what you do, it contributes to the world. So when you find your dharma, you have these three at the same time. You love what you do, you have expertise, you are good at that, and you contribute. It sounds to me that you found your dharma. Tell me about that.
Yes, I agree with you. I mean, we still live in a world where, you know, you have a lot of rules, yeah. You have a lot of bureaucracy, so that also affects my job. But kind of in the big picture, it's all good. It's like you describe it, and kind of like the positive aspects, you know, they dominate the picture, and I have no issues with what's uncomfortable, because that's part of any job, you know. You also have to do things that, you know, are not only fun.
Yeah.
So I agree, yeah.
Because when we play chess often, it's like we are usually missing the third thing of living, the dharma. We might have passion, we might be good at that, but we don't really contribute because we are just playing for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember reading the book of Agassi, tennis player, when he described that he was top number one player for years, and he hated basically tennis, and he played just for his father. And only after retirement, after some years, when he switched to philanthropy, he found his dharma, because he started to really do something that he was loving, he was good at that, and he was contributing to the world. And often we chess players, professional chess players, often we are missing that third part. Seems we are grandmaster, that good, that, but still something is missing.
Yes, and I believe that when you discover this about chess, it's kind of a breaking point from where you cannot go back anymore. Because you realize that, you know, chess is not the most important thing in the world or in life. And actually, some of the world's best players, it's quite clear that for them chess is everything. And they also think, you know, they are special because they are this and that and chess. And, you know, that gives them an advantage in chess as players. Because, you know, they can give their full energy with full conviction. But the moment, you know, you have a wider horizon and you realize, you know, chess is, you know, one of nice activities in my life, but it's not everything, you are handicapped against those guys.
Absolutely. I felt it when I officially retired. I realized what you described, the horizon. I was stuck there. I realized I don't want to spend any more 12 hours on chess. And if you don't spend on 10 hour, 8 hour, whatever there is, you will never improve against that competition. So I was like, okay, there is nowhere it's going. I will stop this and I will switch to coaching. I will do other things. So 100% agree with that. And many people think, especially this young generation, that they will become one day grandmaster. So they will be happy. And there is this like big, how to say, it's lie or something wrong, that it's not the answer. Do you think so? It can if you love game, you improve, yeah, but
yes.
It's not that once you become a grandmaster, every grandmaster in the world are happy, they are...
Yeah, of course not. I mean, I think the process of improving, and you know that you have a moment where you're really satisfied with yourself, like these are the moments that make also investing time worthwhile. And then the grandmaster title, you know, this is a stop on the way, yeah. In the end, okay, for, you know, strong players, anyways, at some point it becomes clear you will get there, and you don't obsess about it anymore. At least that was the case for me. When I started to be serious about chess, you know, like around 14 years old, people would ask me, so what are your goals with titles? I was like, you know, I want to be international master by then and grandmaster by 19. And I actually managed. So that wasn't the goal. And when I was a grandmaster, I still felt like I was quite a bad player, because I was measuring myself against my own expectations.
Mm-hmm.
Then this title didn't change that. And actually, it was real top players that at some point kind of made an assessment of me. And, you know, they thought I will go to 2700 plus. And
who from top players?
Actually, Kramnik and Kasparov.
They said that you will cross 27.
Yes. Well, about Kramnik, I learned that later from someone else. Before I played him, he said this to his second. But with Kasparov, I was briefly working with him. That's now a long time ago, in 2010 maybe.
You're working with him like one-on-one? Or?
Well, back then he had this collaboration with Magnus.
Yep.
And that was also when Magnus kind of really broke through to number one and clearly dominating everyone. And Kasparov wanted to create a team of trainers that would work like 2 years with Magnus until he becomes world champion. And I was the first one on Kasparov's list. So, you know, he established contact through someone we both knew, and then he calls me, and then we start talking, and he tells me this, and the idea...
He called you, you mean you pick the phone and you say, who is this, and say, it's
no,
Gary
Kasparov? I knew it's gonna be. So, yeah, this was surreal, but basically, yeah, he explained that, you know, now we will start with you, you'll work with me to support Magnus on preparation.
They wanted you to teach French to Magnus.
No, luckily, no. So there was this tournament, Weikernsee, and during the tournament, basically every day, Gary was telling me what the plan is for the next day, give me stuff to analyze. Next morning, I show him, you know, my conclusions. He was testing me. So he was satisfied afterwards, and then I had one training session with Magnus in Norway a bit later, just me and him. And then they told me that they had finished the collaboration with Kasparov. And basically this idea of team was abandoned because I was Kasparov's pick, not Magnus. So then Magnus kind of created a team
himself,
More that's kind of more or less his friends and in a circle, So, well. But yeah, there was this episode and basically Gary was telling me, you know, he was happy with my work and now when I also work with Magnus, for sure, soon I'll be 2700. Will also be good for me. So, but actually, after the session with Magnus 2010, that was very interesting. Because working with these two guys, I could see with my own eyes and feel myself that I will never reach their level. You know, like, it's you touch God and you understand this is God and this is me, yeah? And after this experience, I actually had some kind of mini depression, I would say. And like I played quite badly, like the events that followed, because I struggled, you know, with this. One tournament I was playing, trying to play as lightly as Magnus, and then I played very badly. And that helped me make the decision also to turn away from being a professional player. Because I knew, okay, if I work very hard, maybe I'll be top 20, you know, that's it. But I will never be not even close to them. And that made it easier for me to kind of make a cut.
How was it like when you said, when you spent time with Kasparov and Carlsen, you felt it's like totally different things? How did you, like, what was the different thing?
Kasparov has enormous intensity. Like, after Magnus plays some games, he calls me and talks about the critical moments and, you know, some sharp lines and giving his idea and very intense. And when we talk about preparation, some position, very sharp also, you know, he has ideas, he talks and it's all super intense. And this intensity I had never witnessed before with another player. You know, like I had to focus 110% just to follow everything he was saying. You know, just in my mind to follow the lines. And because he would tell me, you know, you look at this and then this line, boom, boom, boom. And then the next line, boom, boom, boom. And if I don't remember, I wouldn't be able to analyze because he's just telling me all the lines that I should be looking at. If I don't remember that, okay, we can stop right there. Yeah. So,
is that about Carlsen?
No, that's different.
He was also intense?
No.
No?
No. It's clear with him that he's really universal as a player. Like, we were playing at some point in our session blitz games. And he wanted to basically play the King's Indian as black as preparation for this... what is it? They had this tournament, Blindfold and Rapid, in Monaco, Amber something. So he wanted to play King's Indian there. He had gotten some files by Kasparov. And so he said, George, let's play, you know, blitz games in the King's Indian. Which lines do you know? We will play all of them, yeah? And, of course, sometimes I would get, you know, some large advantage. And sometimes not, yeah, sometimes he would just outplay me. But every time he had a bad position, the first moment I played inaccurately, I could really feel how he brings life to his position. Like, he's one step away from taking the initiative, like pressuring me, even though he's still worse, you know. And, you know, in any position, he has this ability to coordinate, find harmony, and like push back very quickly. The moment you give him, you know, some maneuvering space. And to see this, wow, it's impressive. And this playing Blitz, yeah. So I didn't lose all the games, but most, yeah. And I could just feel this. That, yeah, any position, he just, yeah, it's impressive. So the positions that are my strong side, I feel that our evaluations were pretty much the same, and probably my understanding is close to his level in my positions. But in everything else, he's just much stronger.
In your positions, you mean in calm positions?
Yeah, where it's kind of about strategic features of the position, positional play, you know, what you play on, or to identify here there is something to play on, some nuance. So there we were kind of on the same wavelength.
But once it's a dynamic game, it's different.
Yeah, well, I have, so to say, my limited sphere, and outside that, yeah, there's a very big difference.
Did he ever try to beat you in French? In your positions when you were beating Anand?
Well, we had this game that we played at the Olympia 2 years ago.
Uh-huh.
I actually, you know, got good position out of the opening, and it was kind of equal until I started misplaying and got this slightly worse endgame where I defended for 80 moves and then in the end I stumbled. But kind of, so to say, in terms of the opening, there was no problem. And, you know, he overpowered me at some point, like he does against so many guys of any level.
Would you say that when you spend time with Kasparov and Carlsen, and it's usually to play worse, yeah? It's like you felt like it's, I'm not getting there. At the same time, that feeling often inspires others, maybe because they are not touching like top.
Mm.
I remember when I spent time with better players, for example, at some period after becoming a Grandmaster, I was spending time with Akopian Vladimir, who was 150 points higher than me. I would see how much I don't know, and it was inspiring at opening my eyes. Oh, I don't know this much. Like, no problem, I will learn and get there. So often, whenever I would spend time with those people, it was like, oh, inspiring, and oh, I can also go there and do that.
Mm.
But when you said, like, you spent with Kasparov and Carlsen, it's top of the top, it's maybe different story.
So, yeah. For example, with Kramnik, in the first games, he was always beating me, and then he was gracious enough to analyze afterwards, you know, like in the old days. And in analysis, he was not impressive at all. And the games, they were also kind of, he went to positions where he identified I'm not good at them, but they are also not his strong positions. So both sides making lots of mistakes, and, well, eventually, you know, he got me, but I always felt, you know, like,
there is some, I have chance.
Yeah, it's the way my games with Anand went, if I would only play with Anand, maybe I would think I can be world champion. So yes, with Carlsen and Kasparov, that was simply another level of experience.
Wow. That's very interesting. So it's like, before you were comparing you with yourself, you with your expectations, but now you had to compare with these guys, and it's like,
yeah.
It was slap.
No, but I mean, as an experience, it was fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, I was very lucky to have all these experiences, even when I was growing up. Like, I was like 17, not yet a grandmaster, just 2400 IM. I had some one-on-one training session with Karpov a whole day long.
Karpov?
Yes.
Wow.
And that helped me a lot, actually, this one day. It was like playing 20 instructive games against a much stronger player. That's what this felt like. And I got it in one day.
Wow.
So it led me to change some opening and really make some progress. Because I had, it's a funny story, so at that point I had some success playing the Bogo Indian, and some not so great lines, but I was almost winning every game, and in Bundesliga I had just beaten Krasenkov, who was like 2660 at that point, and then I analyzed all my Bogo Indian lines all day long with Karpov, and I never had the feeling that, you know, I have any chances. Like, he was always dominating. Like, always worse, no perspective, you know, I will just suffer. And so after that I understood Pogo Indian is an inferior opening, and I started to play some classical Queen's Gambit. So I put a pawn on d5, and these positions, they felt so much better. So that was a really big learning experience for me. Because without Karpov, I wouldn't understand, you know, that there's, you know, the classical openings with the pawn in the center. And, well, they are better, because he showed me what's wrong with my stuff.
Wow. So you have spent, like, not many people who are not in the top 20.
Yes.
Have not, like, you spent with all of them. And
it's like Alice in Wonderland, yeah?
Yeah. Spending time with Karpov, going through openings, playing with Carlsen, playing in Bundesliga and Baden with Kramnik and Anand, and also getting a call and, hey, it's Gary. Oh, yeah, Gary.
No, I was very lucky with all these things. And, for example, this training with Karpov, yeah, that's happened in the German context, so also good things happened there.
Now you are living quite different life, right? Well, it's difficult to compare, yeah, that times your excitement for life or happiness for life, whatever word we can find, and now what you are living, so you are totally different things, right?
Yeah, actually now I get a lot of pleasure from my job. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I also get to travel. I was recently in the Democratic Republic of Congo and got to see firsthand what we do there in our project. It was a project in the health sector where in rural communities we would support basic healthcare for children, for women, young mothers, also other groups with difficulties. And there would be 90 so-called health centers. It's basically like a bungalow where you have a doctor and some nurses. And around there, there's like, let's say, a village, no streets. Everyone is carrying things on their head. And when they have needs, they go see the doctor. Mm-hmm. If there is no doctor, they will give birth to the baby in the hut. You know, it's on that level. And, well, I really got to go there into such a village and see that. And see also how difficult this work is. I got to know the guy who was implementing all of this over 9 years for us, met a lot of the local partners, and got a sense of what the life looks like there. And it also leads me to have a different kind of respect for people living such a difficult life. Because when you see that day in, day out, they're working, you know, for $2-3 a day just to have enough to eat for themselves or for the family, and you know, that's the everyday life. And there is no 8 hours work and then you go home and watch some TV. Like, that's serious. And there to, well, be involved and be able to make a small contribution by working in this, that's really nice.
When you see that, when you saw that kind of lives, if you lose a game, probably just recalling that there are such lives and I'm feeling bad because I lost the game, probably you will feel bad that you feel bad, yeah?
Yeah, almost, yeah. Well, I understand, you know, that being born in a country like Germany, that's already a huge privilege. And going there, that adds a lot to this, a whole new perspective on, you know, how good a life we're actually living. And I can't complain about anything in everyday life in Germany. Yeah. Because if a train is late, I know that most people will never see such a train in their life.
In German, train is late.
Yeah, nowadays, yes. But and yeah. Actually, the only thing that will always frustrate me in German society is that too many people don't understand what a good life they have.
I think it's just in the world, in everywhere. It's not just Germany. Like, you take any country, they cannot, like, see. There is, somewhere I read it, it's written, I was sad that I didn't have shoes, mm-hmm, until I met someone who didn't have legs.
Yeah. But with the countries that I've lived in, that I've seen while I was 3 years in the US, like I have this comparison, and I feel like Germany for a very long time has had a system in place that allows a lot of people to live a decent life. So it's much more social than obviously the US, where a much greater share of the population is struggling. And in Germany, you know, really a lot of people have a good life. You know, we have like the basically health insurance is covered. There's usually a 30 days of paid vacation. If you lose your job, you know, you get enough money from basically the social system so that for 1 year you can look for another job and still have money to pay your bills. You know, like it's really good, yeah. Germany is not as rich as the United States, but it has a system
yeah.
that basically is focused on giving most people possible a decent life. And that's actually why I like to live in Germany, because this appeals to me. Now, me personally, I'm probably someone who could perhaps benefit from living in a country like the US, you know, where if you're at the top, you're rewarded big time. For myself, I don't need it. I'm happy with what I see in Germany. But of course, it's a very individual view.
Okay. the my typical like last question is, what advice do you have for people who want to improve? But to you, I want to ask a little bit different one, similar to that. What advice do you have for people who want to improve, to become titles, grandmaster or whatever, and they think that that will buy them happiness?
Oh, the last part of your question makes it difficult. Because you should enjoy chess to start with. Then you're in the right place and yeah, just
embrace
continue.
The journey?
Yes, exactly. If you don't enjoy the journey and just think that at the end there is going to be some golden, you know, bag of gold waiting for you, of course you'll be disappointed. But I also want to answer your question about chess improvement in general. Because I see really a lot of people that's like a lot is tied up in the result. Like, doesn't matter the rating, the level, but the result of each game is kind of important, or of each tournament, or to win rating. And this actually makes improving harder, because you should be ready to kind of step outside your comfort zone. If you feel the opening isn't the right one for you, yeah, maybe you have studied it for a year, played so many games, but no, switch. And then maybe you'll pay a price for a bit, but like this you learn more about chess and your understanding grows, and in the end you will become a better player. Don't be afraid, you know, that you know some game is not gonna go well. Like, this is also something that I would like to tell my younger self.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was also like that, you know, I didn't wanna risk much most of the time, and like this you just limit yourself. You don't allow yourself to realize your potential, no matter what level you have. If you play freely, you know, kind of like a child without worries, that's the best.
I've written an article about with the title Detachment, the power of detachment, and I have inspired to write that from watching an interview of Kobe Bryant, who was giving advice, and he said that you need to detach and focus on growth. Result will come, just growth, and do it as an investment. Just as you invest in something, yet like the moment you invest, you lose something, but you know that in the future you will win. So I absolutely relate what you say, that it's often difficult to detach. But okay, there is this rating system, how much rating you are at, and it makes difficult for us to detach.
And I learned this, understood it very late, but I understood it when I started playing these super tournaments. Because, for example, when I was playing Kramnik, you can imagine, if with white I want to make a draw, I will manage.
Mm-hmm.
But I never tried. Mm-hmm. So I lost a lot of games, but it was at least, you know, worthwhile.
Yeah.
Because you make a draw against some top player, so
and
what?
Then what?
Yeah, you lost the opportunity to actually grow from that game and learn something.
Thank you very much, George. Personally, I learned many things, and I hope next days I will spend more time together and we'll speak about many things. Thank you very much that during in the middle of the tournament you spent time to sit, talk, and share your thoughts with the chess world. Thank you very much.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
Thanks, bro.